So I'm Cecilia. I'm from Sydney, BC, which is near Victoria. I am a long-time Holdenite. My parents have been bringing me here since I was about two. As I grew up, I started coming as a volunteer. In 2009, I was the Hike House assistant, which was great. So I'm totally thrilled to be here on teaching faculty now. It just seems so perfect for me, and hopefully for you as well. So I'm in my normal, non-Holden life. I'm an archaeologist. I have a bachelor's degree from the University of Victoria in anthropology and a master's from the University of Calgary in archaeology. And I work with Canada's Indigenous people. In my coastal work, I've worked on the central coast of BC, kind of halfway between the US border and Alaska. Well, between the US and either side, I suppose. And on deep time depth sites, so end of last ice age era, looking for the first people to come into North America down the coast. So we have really cool things like 13,000-year-old footprints and really cool stuff. I could talk your ear off about that, but that's not what I'm here to talk about today. For my master's research, I worked in the Canadian Arctic. So when I'm an archaeologist and an anthropologist, and when I saw last summer the call for proposals for teaching faculty to went out, they wanted people to teach on themes of bridging gaps between peoples. And I thought, that's what I do. That's archaeology. That's my master's research. Here I am. As I said, I made a panoramic virtual tour of Arviagerac National Historic Site. So where's that? So Arviagerac is on the northwest coast of Hudson's Bay. So here we have North Dakota, Minnesota, here, and then Saskatchewan, Manitoba, Ontario, and Nunavut. I will talk your ear off about Nunavut as well if you want. It is was divided out of the Northwest Territories, and it is Inuit run territory. It's very, very cool. Arviat is a little town right up there. It doesn't look that far north in the grand scheme of Canada, but Churchill, Manitoba, which has all the polar bears and is pretty famous, is down here in Manitoba. Arviat is Arctic. It's packed in with sea ice most of the year, and polar bears, sled dogs. It's Arctic.
Narwhals?
Narwhals. Yeah. I didn't see any. I did end up taking part in a rather impromptu beluga hunt, which I was just on my way to Arviagerac, which here's Arviat, the town of Arviat. You can see it's not very big. Here's the gravel landing strip. And the island of Arviagerac is up here. And it is a glacially formed esker, kind of a gravel bar. And on our way there by boat, it was the end of August. It's beluga hunting season. The elders who were taking us there said, spotted a beluga and said, do you mind? Well, you have to feed your family. So here I am, sitting in this little boat. We're bobbing and weaving and chasing a beluga. The things you never know you're gonna get into. So Arviagerac is about a 40-minute boat ride from Arviat. So Arviat itself is pretty remote, right? It's up in the Canadian Arctic. You've got to fly there in the summer or in winter, or supplies can come up by barge in the summer. And Arviagerac is another 40 minutes by boat. You have to have a good weather day. You have to have a guide who knows the area who can take you there and maybe hunt beluga along the way. And you need, if you're Inuit, if you are from here and know the way, you need to have the means to have a boat and fuel. So that means that Arviagerac is inaccessible to most people, even including people who live in Arviat. So what is Arviagerac and why is it significant? So the island is an Inuit heritage site. So when, before contact or before people congregated, settled permanently in Arviat, people would spread out in the interior, in the mainland in the winter, to follow the caribou herds, and they'd be quite dispersed. And in the summer, people would congregate on the coasts, and Arviagerac is one of these places where they would do so. And people then would do the things that people do when they get together, when they haven't seen their friends and their relatives in many, many months. Of course, they would hunt and fish, but also sing songs and conduct ceremonies and play games, the things that people do. And so, because this island is made of glacial till, people have built up these forms that are still there, that reflect what they were doing. And so here we have an offering can. And it's quite stunning on the landscape as you walk across this really low-lying island. So in that way, Arvianjrak is really a cultural landscape. So people's activities are reflected in the way they arrange these stones on the island. And the site is really dense with named features. All of these features have Inuktitut names and associated oral history and traditional knowledge. So this traditional knowledge is tied to the landscape. So, for instance, these are the outlines of stone kayaks. This was a marine mammal hunting game that people played with a complex set of rules. And so there's a lot of oral history and a lot of traditional knowledge that's tied to these stone features. So, it's hard to bring people to Arvianjrak, right? And when Arvianjrak was designated a national historic site, we'll get into this, but the community lobbied the federal government to have this place protected and recognized as a national historic site, which means that it is significant to, the site is significant to the fabric and the story of Canada, because the Inuit's history is part of the story of Canada. So then it's going to need a well-conceived outreach program because it's hard to get people there.
The people that are there now, are they the Inuits? Or
yeah.
It's almost all Inuits there now.
Yeah, mostly it's just a population thing. It's really remote. You do have Euro-Canadians in Arviat, but not a lot. The population is 96% Inuit, and it's first language in Inuktitut.
People live on the island or no?
People don't live on this island anymore. They live in Arviat, but they still come to the island to hunt seals because there's a really good tidal flow that comes past, and it's a really good fishing spot.
How big is Arviat?
Arviat itself is about 2,000 people.
2,000?
Yeah. And but growing, it's booming.
Oh, so the children are staying then?
So far. And the elders are working really, really hard. And this is part of this project. The elders are working really, really hard for there to be something in Arviat for their kids.
Are rising seas affecting this?
Yeah, they will. And increased storm surges. At the moment, the glacial history geologically isn't so far away that in this area, so Arvianjrak is still isostatically rebounding from the weight of the glaciers. So what happens after an ice age is that, or after glaciers retreat, is that the glaciers have been pushing down on the land. And of course, sea levels have been lower as well, because a lot of that water is tied up in the glaciers. And then when the glaciers melt, sure, the sea level rises, but the ground is rebounding as well. And so you can actually see, actually this is a great photo to talk about this, all of these beach ridges along here, the island has been isostatically rebounding. So far, the island has been springing up faster than sea levels have been rising. Climate change is probably going to change, but that's where it is right now. I love all these questions. What I want to do with this is not just talk about my research, but start a conversation as part of that Holden's call to equip and send thing. Start these conversations that then you can take with you later on. So keep asking questions. I'm happy to be interrupted. So, let's make it so you can hear me.
Yeah.
Is that better?
That's
yes.
Better.
Okay.
Way better.
So we consulted with the community. They needed a well-conceived outreach program, and they had two goals, right? So there's how do you bring outside people to Arviat or Arviat to outside people? But also, they wanted an engaging way to talk to their youth about this traditional knowledge, get their youth interested. So this project was really as much community-driven, and we were just a platform. So we decided to bring our Viajak to the public and give the community an interactive way to teach their culture and their history to their youth. So we decided to, as part of a project that was already ongoing at the University of Calgary, where Denis Gavois, here from the art department at the University of Calgary, and my master's supervisor, Peter Dawson, went up to Arvia and took panospheric photos. So it was part of a project that was already going on in which they were using photospheres to contextualize traditional Inuit placings. So that's why they were already up there. When this push came from the community, we have this place that we had designated as a National Historic Site. We need a well-conceived outreach program. So then I come in, or actually, here they are doing, they did pole mounted and drone digital SLR, panospheric photography. So then this is where I come in. We already have this project ongoing. They hand me the photospheres from this island and say they want a well-conceived outreach program. We're thinking of panoramic virtual tour. So I used a program called Panatour Pro, and I turned those panoramic images into a virtual interactive tour. So the tour contains videos of elders speaking at key spots on the island, as well as clickable boxes with information on the archaeological features, the cultural knowledge, oral history, and also natural landscape things like the beach ridges. So about polar bears, plants that are on the island, that kind of thing. It's mostly in English, but some of the videos, the elders are speaking in Inuktitut instead. And this is a whole other can of worms that we can get into. I would have loved to have the funding to have English and Inuktitut subtitles under all of the videos, no matter what language they're in, and all of the text in English, French, and Inuktitut. I have the means of translating it into French, but I don't have the means of translating it into Inuktitut, and we didn't have the funding.
Can you say the name of the Inuit language again?
Inuktitut.
Say it again.
Inuktitut. So one. So many people are Inuit. One person is an Inuk.
Inuk.
Inuktitut is the language.
Inuktitut.
Inuktitut. Yeah.
Is that language spoken all through Nunavik, or?
It's actually spoken pretty widely across the Arctic from. Parts of northern Alaska, the parts of it are more coastal, but the northern bits, through northern Canada, through Greenland. It was a pretty wide population migration that went really fast and took that language all the way across, and there are dialectal differences, but people can largely understand each other. Yeah.
Yeah, the little snowman, he's got a Inuktitut or something. Is that the same base word?
Yeah, Inukshuk. Yeah, Inuk person. Yeah, and there are Inukshuks, here's another tangent, but there are Inukshuks that look like, we think of Inukshuks, and they look like little people, and those are for directing caribou herds towards crossings where they can be more easily hunted as they swim across narrows in lakes and stuff, more easily hunted by kayak. And there are other Inukshuks that are still called Inukshuks that don't look anything like we down here think of, but there are also kind of signal stones, and it's a whole language in cairns about this is a good place to fish Arctic char, and here's a good place to get out of the wind, and things like that.
So I assume the written language is...
in syllabics. I've got a picture, I can show you later.
Okay.
Yeah, it's very cool. So it's in Inuktitut. So some of the videos are in Inuktitut, and I don't have subtitles for them in English. But also the English videos, I don't have subtitles for them in Inuktitut. And so I would have loved to have funding to do it all, but I actually, in the end, I didn't. And I kind of love that give and take, that some of it is not for us. It's for the community, and it's by the community. And the rest of it is in English, because I'm the one who made it, and I don't speak Inuktitut. And so if they have to cross that language hurdle, then so should we. And that wasn't intentional, but I kind of love how it turned out. So I also built, in addition to building the panoramic virtual tour, I built a website with the help of my in-house tech support. For a practical purpose, I needed a place for the tour to live. But also, it provides important background and contextual information, because if one of us stumbles across the virtual tour and we don't know anything about, like, who are the Caribou, who are the Arvianiut, the Caribou Inuit? What is Arviadra? Where is Arviat? We need to, why did we do this project? How? We need to know these things, and we have no contextual information. So we built this website that hosts the tour and provides this information. And the website, as I said, is in English and in French, because that's what I was able to provide, and I would love in the future to be able to provide it in Inuktitut as well. So then in August, once I had a draft of the tour complete, in August of 2016, I traveled to Arviat to consult with community leaders and elders. So often in the history of researchers from Southern universities, and in the North, they call all the rest of us Southern, even though I come down to the US and you guys call south of where I live Norman. These sort of Southern researchers, or before that, European explorers coming to the Arctic, so they'll come in for 2 weeks, get the wrong impression, leave, and publish it as fact. And that's such a history that's gone on for so long, and I did not want to be a part of it. In fact, because this tour is so much by the community, for the community, I really had to get it right.
What language did you speak?
English.
Okay.
They speak English. The rest of Canada is largely in English and French. And so they learn English and French, and they speak Inuktitut in the home.
So they could translate it for themselves, and they
help
you in that if they want
to. We were looking at having some of the young people from the Arctic College apply for scholarship and research grants in order to facilitate the translation. And it ended up not being within the scope of my master's research. That doesn't mean the project is dead, right? Maybe in the future.
A PhD is maybe all day.
Who knows?
Ask your tech support.
Yeah, talk to tech support. So, Arviat, we answered some of these questions earlier. Arviat is, to contextualize this place, has a population of about 2,000, no paved roads. They have a gravel landing strip in the summer. In the winter, it's snow. All food has to be flown in during times of year that where there's sea ice. So heavier items like soda and like ATV batteries only come up in the late spring when it first thaws, and then again in the late summer before it freezes. Other than that you don't really need soda, and you can kind of May-ish, the whole town will run dry of club soda. And everyone is there pretty much as first language in Inuktitut, and then you'll have outsiders come in as school teachers or as nurses. When I was walking around the town before after I went to the school and did my presentation, everyone knew who I was, and I get stopped in the street about my project. But when I first arrived, they thought I had flown in and I was the dentist. because I was the white person walking through town. So the phone book is in Inuktitut. And so here, where you were asking about Inuktitut, it's written in syllabics because it's a syllabic language. So I met with community leaders and elders, and they went over my tour and my website with a fine-tooth comb. Keep this so you guys can hear me. They're experts in the cultural significance and features of the site. It's in their backyard, it's their heritage. And I had meetings at the Hamlet office, the Department of Education. This is Luke Sulik, he's a community elder who's also the cultural heritage advisor at the Department of Education. And the Nunavut Arctic College branch, the middle school, the visitor center, and everything. We made sure that they made sure that everything was correct, all the facts were correct, and that they were portrayed as they wished to present themselves to the world.
Can you give examples of things that they might have changed?
Yeah. A lot of the background information that I had on the website about who are the Arviat and the Caribou, I had gotten from published resources that I could get down in my university. And they were wrong. Not on the major points, but on a lot of the finer points. Because again, these, a lot of them were based on explorers' accounts, and they came in for a week on a ship and got the wrong idea and published it. And they corrected all of that, which is really important because I can't go around putting their heritage out the way they want, and then on the website I've got who they are all wrong. And so I also presented the tour to the middle school because remember we have these twofold goals, right? We have the bringing RVIJUAC to people, and we also have engaging of the youth. And I couldn't take pictures of kids, but this is Doreen Hannock, she's the principal, and the kids loved it. At the end of the school day, we couldn't get them to leave the classroom and go home. And I was, as I alluded to earlier, constantly stopped in the streets by the kids. You went to my friend's class. You need to come to my class and show this to my class. You need to talk to my teacher. My teacher is Mr. So-and-so. And they all had these iPods, and they downloaded apps to their iPods. And they're like, how do I take Panospheres? How do I, you know? And so the elders were right. This is a really effective way to engage the kids things about their traditional history that they're interested in, but they're usually presented in this really dry way. And then while I was there, I got the kids to draw me some icons. For the draft version of the tour that I brought to Arviat, I had been using simple kind of clip arty icons, some that I'd made myself, some that I just kind of got open source off the internet. But the tour needed to aesthetically represent the people in the area. Inuit art is really distinctive. If this tour was going to be really of the Arviat, it had to reflect them aesthetically as well. So I asked the students to draw me Arviat appropriate icons, and they responded wonderfully. And the young lady who ran the visitor center also was wonderful at providing the icons. So these are some of the drafts. They're just the straight icons I got from them. And then I cleaned them up a little bit and turned them into icons that I used in the tour. And although these icons introduced some ambiguity into the functions of the buttons, I think that the are reflecting the artistic traditions of the Inuit and having the community signature really in the tour is really outweighs that. And there are other ways, and we'll talk about overcoming these ambiguities.
Were you saying you did not have children in the video?
No, yeah, I didn't have parental releases to take pictures or videos of the kids. But they get to have their signature on the tour too. So then after building the tour and taking it through the community, I went to Arviat with Billy Ukatuk. He is a really important person in the community, and his son-in-law, Wayne. And Billy is not that old, but he's respected as kind of one of the knowledge keepers of the community. So elder is not quite the right word for him, but he really is respected as one of the major knowledge keepers. He grew up listening, learning historical sites and oral history from hunters and elders of his, from when he was a kid, and listening to their stories and going out on the land with them. He's a professional guide. He holds certifications with the Canadian Coast Guard, and he's a counselor at the middle school. And I've watched him in action a couple times, and those kids are really lucky to have him. So this gave me a tour not only to... I had lots of interviews with Billy, but this gave me the opportunity to really go across the landscape with Billy in a really in-depth way. And it also gave me the opportunity to really ground truth the project. I had built this kind of virtual tour, I knew it inside and out, and then to go walk across the landscape and make sure that everything was right was a really important thing to do. And it's a good thing I did because I had the mirrors. This isn't a time ring. I had in the literature that I had available to me down at my university, I read about a special tent ring that had two sleeping platforms. There was an extra very large tent ring, and I thought that's what this was. I had it in my panosphere, I had a little icon that explained this, and that's just plumb wrong. This isn't a tent ring at all. Billy told me he'd also originally thought that this was just a really big tent ring, but one of his elders had corrected him. And I looked back in some of the videos that my supervisor and his students had taken over several years, And it's not the first time Billy has said, this looks like a tent ring, but it isn't. Like, he, this is consistent. It's a game, a circle game for expert seamstresses. I don't really know how it's played. But that's what Billy said that his elders had told him.
Did you say seamstresses?
Seamstresses. I don't know how it's played. But the people in the community, the youth, who will hear this, see this on the tour, then they'll ask their elders, and then they'll know.
Is this a good time to talk about the role of women in the society?
Sure. Any time's a good time.
Well, what sort of importance do they have? I mean, if they're, you know, expert seamstresses and there's a game, you know.
They get a game? A game to play?
Well, everyone gets games. In a lot of ways, the society was divided based on division of labor. Different people had different roles, but also reflected that the landscape was really harsh and surviving required everybody. And if there weren't enough kids of boys or girls born in some years and there were shortages, that's a horrible way to say it. If there weren't enough hunters or there weren't enough seamstresses, well, they weren't just going to die because of it. They'd train somebody else to do it, right? It was really the cultural rules had places for everybody. But it was definitely open to change based on necessity.
So were there female elders too?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Yeah. So I noticed that the two guys have rifles slung over their shoulders.
Bear guards.
Sorry?
Bear guards.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. Polar bears, we'll get to them. There are female elders too. In fact, the visitor center is named after Margaret Anaxack, who is one of the major elders. A lot of my information that was oral history that was all very correct was from her. She has since passed away. But when Billy would really want to invoke, like, no, this is right, it came from Margaret. You know? So, no, it's chance, really, that I have a Billy and Luke and not Margaret and Sue, you know? You had your hand up?
I just wondered, are the people that you're working with, are those the ones that were also, has this been an established community since the beginning of the migration of those people?
So, Arviat was one of those places that people congregated, as well as Arviajuk. More people would go to Arviajuk in the summers and not stay on the mainland of Arviat, partially because of the hunting was better over Arviajuk, also a better breeze, the bugs are better. And when you're there, it's a beautiful place to be. So there's the reason people haven't changed that much over time, and the places that we want to be now that are beautiful places to be have been beautiful places for a long time, and people have wanted to be there. When Arviat became a permanent settlement was after the Hudson's Bay Company put a trading post there. People started to go there more often. And then you have the whole tuberculosis, smallpox, residential schools, all of that, schools and hospitals and RCMP stations start to be built in one area, and people start residing permanently in an area. And that's how there are a couple of settlements. But these settlements are in locations where they're, like, the Hudson's Bay Trading Company put trading posts where people already would be going, right? So it's not like they put it in the middle of nowhere, and it seems really remote to us now, but it's not the middle of their nowhere, right? It's the middle of their summer gathering spot, right? These places already have Inuit names. Arviat is Inuit name. It was during the decades before, it has been given an English name, and I actually don't even know it. The next community north is still called Whale Cove, but it has an Inuit name as well. It's about this long, and I wasn't working there and didn't take the time to memorize it, but it's important to call places by the names that they've been called for generations. Arviat is an Inuit name. And the people who are there call themselves the Arvianyu, which means the people of Arviat. The various groups that live in this area, would go inland in the winter and follow the caribou, have been called by the explorers as the caribou Inuit, because they follow the caribou. But they had several different lineage names for their different groups. And all of them end in Inuit, which means a group of. And then when people came into Arviat and populations were very much decreasing, smallpox, tuberculosis, residential schools, they stopped being able, like, people still know where, which descent group they are from, but they collectively are now call themselves the Arvianyu. So, this is one of the games. It's the weightlifting stones. Billy says that people must have been much stronger back then, and I have to agree with them. That is a big rock. And it's, you can't tell in this picture, but just about here, there's a great big, a slope, steep slope. And the game was to roll them down the slope, and then there were two of them, there's another one kind of over here-ish. Two people would each grab one and run them up, and we were about to the top first one. And I'm going, I can't even lift it. And I'm little, but I'm pretty strong. So we had some challenges, of course, to work around. The first challenge is kind of, we call it in academic circles, the digital divide. And you guys kind of experience the digital divide here at Holden as well. This issue of, fact, of very slow internet that kind of can divide you from the greater internet world, right? Here it's a little bit intentional. And in Arviat, and in other places, it is really more about remoteness and about, which kind of is here too as well, but about means as well. And so these technologies like panoramic virtual tours and other projects like it hold promise for engaging broader public in a really constructive way that could lead to greater involvement and dialogue between indigenous communities and the broader public. It's this cross-cultural engagement that hopefully leads to greater respect for indigenous communities and greater availability of knowledge to the general public, a way for the public to experience a site that's too remote to visit in person, and new and innovative ways for elders to teach traditional knowledge to the youth, all these things we've been talking about. However, if people can't access the website, they live in somewhere remote, or they don't have the means to buy fast internet, or they live in a place where you can't get that, then the tour or the website becomes almost as unreachable as our Arviajuak Island itself. So as it currently stands, projects that use technological means of delivering their message will only reach audiences who have the socioeconomic means by which to access them. So then you end up with a divide as well. So how do you overcome this? Because the whole point of this project is overcoming these divides. So on the website that we built, there's a button, you can download the tour when you're on Wi-Fi or on internet to have offline for later viewing. So if you live in a small community, in Arviat, say, people don't have internet in their homes, but there's a terminal at the library, not unlike here. And you can download the tour when you're on the internet. You can let it tick away overnight if you've got really slow internet. And then in the morning, you've got it on your device, you can take it back home and watch the tour, go through the tour offline. So we work on things like that. Also, when I was in Arviat, I used workaround programs on the tablet, on the showing people. The tablet is a self-server. It hosts the tour as if it is its own server. So there are ways to work around this. Two of the things that the community is really interested in that we're still working on and still in contact with people is getting a kiosk at the visitor center that just hosts it there. And the visitor center is a major part of the community that hosts throat singing classes, beading classes, all kinds of things there. We can talk about throat singing later if anyone wants to. And so they really want a kiosk there that's just there. And also they have a teeny tiny one room airport that's about the size of this room that people will get stuck in for hours and hours and hours and days. It took me 3 days to get out of Arvian. they have a TV that shows slideshows, and they really want kind of a slideshow version of the pictures and the intro boxes to go on the slides, because that'll reach a lot of people who are sitting there. And when planes are coming in, man, that place is packed with everyone in the community coming to see who's coming in on the plane. So it's a really great way to reach people as well.
You mentioned it's booming. What is it booming? What's making it boom?
People having kids. Sorry, population growth. The population growth is massive, but I think the population was always historically good, pretty high. And then they had this massive population decline, right, in the colonial area with disease and all this, right? And so it's bouncing back. People are the demographic makeup of Arviat is like this, like young kids, like the period, there's just so many of them. And so they're really, really growing, and the elders are putting a lot of effort into having a good cultural framework and opportunities in place for them.
There's enough jobs?
There aren't a lot of jobs. They've got a branch of the Nunavut Arctic College there now, though.
So how are the people dealing with the kind of age-old issues of, you know, poverty and the legacy of the residential schools and the parents and grandparents' generation?
Yeah, it's a hard one. They're working on it, for sure. They've got issues, of course, at most of these northern communities, of suicide and depression and substance abuse. And a lot of what they're really trying to do, they've got a branch of the Nunavut Arctic College there, and they're trying to get Inuit kids into nursing, into their own communities, so that they can have this community caring for community, rather than having to go to outsiders for help. Really educate, and they've got other projects, kind of like the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, just going through their own communities. They're calling it something healing circle. So they're working on it.
Yeah. So you were talking about when they thought you were the dentist. Does that mean that a dentist would have to come in?
A dentist,
because they wouldn't have one.
They
there.
Don't have one.
So it would be a really big deal if you had a toothache for the last 6 months.
They either think you have a dentist. Well, no, the dentist comes in on a 2 week rotation, I think. So is the doctor.
But they're probably very busy.
They're very busy.
Yeah.
So is the doctor, so is the physio.
Two questions. One is alcoholism a problem?
Arviat's a dry community. They made the decision to be a dry community. So, yes.
And then completely different stuff. So how do they earn income there?
So there aren't a lot of, like, everything that needs to happen in a community, that's what people get jobs doing, right? Like, so there are people at the little bitty airport who work at the airport. There are people who run the little gas pump. There are people who run the grocery store. There are people who... And what they're trying to do with Special Needs Arctic College is to educate, and at the school, they're trying to get these Inuit youth to get the training and education they need so that they can be the dentist, so that they can be all the teachers. So they got a lot of Inuit teachers, but they also don't have enough. So they have a lot of outside teachers come in and they don't speak Inuktitut. So that's what they're trying to build there.
And do people still do a lot of sustenance hunting and fishing?
Yes, quite a lot. So people's way of life has obviously changed. They live in European-style houses and they drive ATVs, but they pull traditional Inuit sleds behind their ATVs and they go out and have caravan. This hasn't, in some ways it's changed a lot, in some ways the basic ways of life haven't changed that much. People are still hunting caribou, people are still hunting beluga on their way to Arviaja, and feeding themselves and their families.
So Canadian government support them?
Yes. Yeah. Well, what do you mean?
Special status, stipends.
There's a northern allowance if you're working in the far north because those things are far more expensive that people get. And there's been a lot of public health outreach and push to have people understand that foods from the land, which is what the Inuit call hunting and fishing and so forth, are really healthy foods. The way that they're hunted by the Inuit is sustainable and that people should be doing this rather than, oh, you shouldn't be out doing that. You know?
Right. What's the average lifespan?
I have no idea.
So do they have to buy licenses from the government?
No, because they're Inuit, no.
Do they use I'm just wondering about healthcare access for those folks, especially if there's a lot of babies being born. Do they do telehealth like they do in other parts of Canada?
Yeah, they do some telehealth for sure. And then there's always a nurse, and there's most of the time a doctor in on a couple-week rotation. But because the doctors come in on rotation, they don't have a permanent doctor, they don't have a lot of continuity there. They have a hospital, to do more than Holden can, right? They're a remote outpost. But if there are complications with the birth, then they have to fly them out. And getting in and out of RFA can be hard. They've got to go to the south. Our south. Still your north. they've got to go to a bigger city in Canada if there are complications. I was talking to the doctor when I was there, and he said he had a young lady who was in labor and she had a complicated birth, and the best hope for her was to give her drugs to pause the labor, get her out, and get her to a proper hospital.
Did you get did they get the beluga?
I was there. And I didn't, Billy kept looking back at me. You're not going to cry. And they were like, no, not while you're here. And I really didn't know whether to root for the beluga or to root for him, because he's got to feed his family.
Right.
This is healthy food. This is really what they should be, not, I shouldn't dictate what they should be doing. This is what they want to do, and this is a good thing. But I don't really want to be there when, the beluga dies or anything. I'm a bleeding heart. So I gained a massive appreciation for how hard it is to hunt an animal that can dive out of sight. Those are very skilled people. So, go ahead.
One more question.
I'm
just wanting to compare in the 48 states when the reservation system was instituted. There were different churches that were assigned to a particular reservation, so different church bodies had different churches. And in Alaska, there were no reservations, but there were different churches that went up to proselytize in different parts of Alaska. And I'm just wondering if anything like that happened in Canada, and if there are, like, the Seward Peninsula, for instance, was the Lutheran area. And then Presbyterians were in the southeast.
Let's save that conversation for Thursday when I talk about residential schools and the role of the church.
Oh, okay.
Is that okay?
That's
fine. Okay. Because I just heard the lunch bell, so we're coming in.
Yeah, 15 minutes.
All right. So the other big issue that we had has to do with really virtual reality itself, which is that disorientation. People don't know where they are in this virtual space. And so we put in a 2D locator map, which you can click on this and it'll pop up and show you where you are, like which panosphere is map of the island, and with little icons for each of the panospheres and a little cone which tells you which panosphere you're on and which direction you're facing. So that really helps people orient and know where they are. And then the other issue was how to operate the tour. So on the intros, when you first launch the tour, there's a voiceover, my voice, saying, welcome to the Arpège National Historic Site Virtual Tour, to navigate this tour. And I go over how to navigate it. But also, at all times during tour, you can click on this, and it'll pop up this navigation tips window, so that if you're having trouble, you can figure out how to navigate the tour. And then there's the legend. So the students, as I alluded to earlier, their art added some ambiguity to the function of the icons. how are you supposed to know this pops up on that? You know? I mean, but it's great student art. So we added a legend that tells you that this is a map. I mean, some of them are obvious. I mean, polar bear is polar bear. And this really helps also alleviate some of that ambiguity. So then future direction, I've talked a little bit about it already, that we are still working on the kiosk at the Margaret Annex Visitor Center, and we're still working on getting the slideshow up at the airport. So the other things we're doing that I would love to do that we're not working on yet, but that would be fantastic, are a more immersive virtual reality. So these are the Google Cardboard headsets, and then we'll pass some of them around. Can I get my lovely in-house tech support? So currently, I have the Panospheres that you can put into a virtual reality headset and look around just the Panospheres. And in the future, you could build the tour such that you could navigate through the entire tour and all of the videos of the elders and the pop-up info boxes through the headset, which would be a much more immersive tour. And then also, what I would love to do is this translation into Inuktitut. If the entire thing were translated into Inuktitut in addition to English and French, it would be eligible for approval as support material for the Nunavut school curriculum, which would be great. So, kind of, here's Billy watching himself in the tour. Kind of in conclusion, this project really demonstrates the importance of public outreach and engagement of the local community. And overcoming the challenges of the digital divide in different communities. And that knowledge is power for Indigenous youth, and that this is really the first step to respect and understanding from the outside world. What I wanted to do with kind of my, all of my talks this week is kind of that knowledge is power and is the first step towards understanding, and understanding is the first step towards respect, and that's the first step towards dismantling racism, right? And it seems like a really big goal, but we start with knowledge and understanding. Because what people don't know, they can't respect or value. And it's easier for a largely Euro-Canadian or Euro-American, North American public to devalue and disrespect Indigenous communities if they know little about the rich and often impressive heritage of these Indigenous communities. Outreach and engagement of the public is of great importance for Indigenous heritage sites. And this virtual tour of Arviagerac National Historic Site is of value as a proof of concept for other sites. I'd love to see this done on a bigger scale with bigger than a grad student budget. By overcoming the challenges of remoteness, we can promote understanding and engagement across cultures, generations, languages, and geography. This has far-reaching effects in terms of policy changes and what the future looks like for all of us. Descendants of the colonizers, immigrants, and Indigenous peoples all living together into the future. None of us are leaving. Right? In some places, like in Greenland, they had this Danish colonial rule, and then the Danish kind of largely went home, not entirely, but largely. And the Greenlandic and Greenlandic Inuit are under self-government now. That's not going to happen in North America. We all live here now. This is all of our home. So we're not leaving. So we all really need to learn to get along with respect and understand what each other has to offer, and that really starts with understanding each group's heritage. So immersive outreach, such as virtual tours, are potentially powerful tools to connect people to heritage sites that might otherwise be inaccessible. The elders' goal of finding a way to bring Arviagerac to their youth and to the wider world was attained by this project, as the Arviagerac tour is now available anywhere where there is internet, and youth adults alike in Arviat were very interested in the tour. And even places where there isn't internet, we can work around it. So, here is the...
My laptop's muted.
Well, I can just launch the tour itself. Show the laptop tour itself.
Sure.
Yeah, this is just a video.
National Historic Site Virtual Tour. Here are some tips for navigation. To look left and right in the photos, click and drag the picture from side to side. To close videos, click on the video itself. To return to this start photo at any time.
So I'm gonna lower so I can talk over myself. I'm happy to go through the tour for anyone who wants to see stuff that's in it. I'm really happy to answer questions. Yeah, feel free to look around as the canisters get passed around. Careful, there's a button on the right, upper right-hand side. Careful not to touch it because that'll do funny things. That's the call for the looking for internet to load that TV locator map.
So if we, yeah. When we go home and have access to the internet, we can just get on www.rvi.org.
Printed off cards. If I can find them, I can hand out little cards that have the website so that everyone can go home and look it up. Because I would love this to be the start, my goal is for this to be the start of a conversation. And my email address is on the cards. So you can contact me, and there's also a contact button on the website that will also get to me. Here we go. It was underneath my bus stairs.
Are you pursuing funding to take this particular project further? Or?
At the moment, I'm just working as an archaeologist in Victoria, but I would love to pursue funding to take this further. Yeah.
So you work for the Canadian government now?
I work for a private company that does archaeological mitigation when there's like construction that's going on in kind of sites. Here, let's. Oh, here, no. Do you want one of these too? You don't have to. That's okay.
What area are you working in?
Victoria.
In Victoria.
Yeah, that's where we're from.
Do they have a Lutheran church in Victoria?
Yeah, there are some. I don't know. But they are there. So, what do people want to see?
Polar bears.
Polar bears? Okay, polar bears.
Yeah.
We can do polar bears. Can we do polar bears? And the polar bears, let me tell you, are like this tall at the shoulder, and they hunt humans. Like, these are no white black bears. And one of my favorite moments on RV Azurac. I can jump ahead to one of the polar bears.
Did you find that the kids were quicker at all this than the older people?
Oh, they were all over it. Yeah. Oh, so this is the Caribou Crossing game. So there's a line of stones here, and then there's a line of stones there. And it's basically Red Rover, if any of you have played that.
Yes.
Except what it is, it's of course in this cultural context that the lines of stones are riverbanks, and the people on the riverbanks are hunters, and the people in between are caribou, and they're trying to cross the river, and the hunters are trying to catch the caribou before they cross the river. So it's kind of like Red Rover. So here's a video of Billy and his son. And I did not take the video. I apologize for it. It's very shaky, it's not me.
And I will be running from that other side. And I will be running. And if I can run faster, I'm going to be closer to his side. If he runs faster than me, he's going to be closer to my side. But when he gets to me, or when I get to him, he's out. You do like this, or the other person could be like this, or it can be a simple push like that. Remember where a worm gummy?
Yeah.
They're very slippery.
Comics are as silly.
It's time now. Then that means I am weaker than him, and he's stronger than me. The game does not end. He won, I'm out, so there's more people coming in until a couple are left, like top athletes or the strongest men, and they were seen as very healthy, very strong.
There's Billy on that, but terrible crossing game. And then there's the kayak game. These are those stone kayaks. Yeah, there's a really great aerial view of it.
That was taken with the drone. That's
like, yeah, that's taken with the drone. And so there are a couple of ways to play this game, from what I've heard. There's a video of Billy I'll show that in one way of playing it. The other way was that these were whales, and that you would throw your spear, and then you'd move back more kayaks or more kayaks further back. And then there's more of a hunting from the water game.
And the man with the rope would be dragging the rope going around each kayak, and each time the hunter hits the loop or the noose, they would get a rock from there. As we can see here, he has several rocks too. And that game went on until the rocks, either the kayaks were sunk or all the rocks were gone. And whoever had the most rocks, if they wanted to challenge each other, if they played the game again. But
well, then here's some. Let's do this. And yeah, that you can see the beast ridges we were talking about isostatic rebound.
Can we see a video of Inanakta?
Yeah. Was that one in Inanakta back there?
Yeah.
Yeah. I love listening to it. I really love airplane
announcements on the trip. They're way more calming. I'm going to go to the airport.
Is there any loss of indigenous language with the young?
Inuktitut and Cree are probably going to in Canada. They're likely to survive, unfortunately. But Inuktitut and Cree are going to be strong.
Okay, so in RVI, all the children would know anything.
There's speaking Inuktitut first language in the home, which is really, really important.
Yeah.
And then there hasn't been in the past a lot of wider support for that. Like all of the schooling was in English, and that's still a little bit the case because we're still getting a lot of the teachers, the qualified teachers, are coming from the South. But it's starting to change. And there's getting to be, we're moving away from that, and we'll talk about this in the residential school session as well, but we're moving away from that, like, it's best if everyone learns English, right? We're starting to get into, no, it's good if these languages survive. These languages carry so much cultural knowledge embedded in the language. You know, like, what do the English speak? English. What do the French speak? French. What do the Inuit speak? Well, they should be speaking English, but, right? But they want to be. So that's starting to change, and there's support in the written language, in Korean and in the Inuktitut. And there's a big enough population that's speaking it. One of the problems with a lot of the other smaller languages is there's not a big enough population that's still speaking it.
So they also have their script, their
writing.
They keep their writing letters too?
Yeah.
Because that's like school, right?
Yeah, so Inuktitut syllabics are being taught in schools now.
So when you encountered a polar bear on the island there,
on the beach,
that's a small island.
Uh-huh. So
were there ever any altercations?
So this guy here, we were standing right here on the rocks, and Billy said he wanted to go first to look over the edge to make sure it was safe. And he goes, okay, you can come, but like carefully, because there's a bear right there on the beach. And he wasn't that far away, but he's down on the beach. And Billy is trying to, like, get him to go away. And so he's clapping his hands, and he's banging the rocks together, and he's like, ah! And finally, and the bear's just kind of doing his own thing. Finally he goes, hey, Nanook! Which means, like, hey, you polar bear. And he looks at us. We go, oh, you know your name.
That's cool.
And And then the bear goes,
big sigh.
And he starts marching away, right? He goes, he was not impressed with us.
Is that something they would hunt? Or something they would shoot for protection?
A little column A. Who's the hunter here, right? The polar bear hunts people for sure. And you're told, don't go out by the shore at night. That's where the polar bears come in. It's not safe. Children aren't allowed to go trick-or-treating in Arviat because they will get eaten by polar bears who are jumping out from between houses. But also, people also hunt polar bear for their claws, for their teeth, for their coat. That polar bear fur is really dense and rich.
Meat?
But not for the meat?
Nope, it's noon. Apparently my hour's up.
they don't eat the polar bear meat, though?
Not traditionally. There might be some of it. It's not large. It's not really... I mean, I'm sure in time of hunger people would. But the ones that... The animals that people really go for as mainstays are caribou, seal, beluga, fish.
Thank you.